Good morning, all. It's another beautiful day. Your attention, please.
Hey there, welcome again to Back in the Village, the Prisoner Podcast. This is episode 14, Living in Harmony. Nothing in the notes this week, except, well, we do have some extended talk about the movie Tombstone, so I'll put some links up to that. Even though if you don't know the movie Tombstone, you should. I'd also like to thank everyone who's been sending us emails or following us on Twitter at Prisoner Podcast. We love reading your feedback, and we hope to hear some more, so keep on sending it in. We look forward to it. So, without further ado, here is Living in Harmony.
Good morning, good morning. We're here at Back in the Village, the Prisoner Podcast.
My name
is Clay McCormick from EatDeadMeat.com, and with me, as always, is Wes Teasdale. How are you doing, Wes?
I'm doing real well there, Clay. I feel the morning's really gotten nice over here.
Yeah, I guess I should have said howdy howdy at the beginning.
Yeehaw!
Because today we're talking about the episode 14 of The Prisoner, Living in Harmony. Harmony was a quiet place until the sheriff rolled into town, and that's as far as I'm going to go with that joke. But
it was good. I think we're both. I'd give you a B plus. I'd give me a B minus. I think.
So we're talking about Living in Harmony, which is episode 14 of The Prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
Getting close to the end here.
Yeah.
It was written and directed by David Tomlin, assistant director for the show. Has been there since the beginning. Was a co-creator of the show and co-writer of Arrival. So he's got a pedigree for the show. It was based on a story by Ian Rakoff, who actually was an editor on the show.
Okay.
And after the production, after the show did not get renewed for a full 13 episode second season, and everybody kind of left. Mark Steen left, like we covered last episode, and some other production people left and writers left. They were kind of put out an open net for writers, which is never a good sign.
Yeah, yeah.
And, excuse me.
Submit your spec scripts for The Prisoner.
Ian Rakoff was an editor, and I read that he was tapped by McGoohan specifically to write this.
Okay.
I don't know if it's, again, with everything concerning how the show went down, there seems to be some sort of gray area where I think what happened was Rakoff had the idea, and then McGoohan said, "You, expand on that idea." And then David Tomlin jumped in and kind of took it, and I know Rakoff was very upset because when the show aired, Tomlin had pretty much the only writing credit.
Yeah.
Which, you know, David Tomlin.
The series feels like a credit grab by everyone involved.
Yeah,
everyone
it's like, really weird.
Yeah.
You'd think they wouldn't have time for this. Or at the very least, you'd think with everybody who worked on the show talking about how much of a shit show it was and how no one knew what was going on, you'd think you wouldn't want to grab the credit for this show.
Yeah.
You know,
Like
if people are seeming like it's a ship without a captain and it's going down at some point, it surprises me that anyone would want to be like, no, yep, that was all me.
Yeah. I don't know how royalties work on things like this.
Yeah.
Like I know you want the credit. But do pen names count as your name on a script?
That's a good question. I don't
or
know.
Do you not get paid for your pen name stuff?
That's a very good question. I have no idea. If we have any listeners who work at the BBC, please send us an email.
Any Writers Guild East members who listen to this, let me know how you get your check for 17 cents every week. It feels weird to me, like, because it was happening on, not to always bring up Star Trek, but it's on Star Trek where they'd, as a sort of form of protest, they'd put a pen name onto something.
Yeah.
But I didn't...
Alan Smithy.
Right. And I wouldn't know if they'd want to be... Because people know. It's not like it's a mystery who wrote it. Because everywhere you look, you can see, like, this was a pen name for blah, blah, blah. So I don't know if it's purely a symbolic thing or if you're actually losing financial gain from doing
it. Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to, the only thing I can really think of that's close to that now is how Alan Moore doesn't want his name put on any movies that are made
yes.
from his stuff. I think I'm pretty sure he doesn't even take money for it. Like he would be getting residuals for that stuff.
Right.
I don't think he takes it.
Because I'd assume they'd want to list him as a producer or something.
Yeah.
And if they're not doing that, you're not going to
pay. He doesn't want it. And actually, even Marvel just re-released, or I should say reprinted, his series Miracle Man.
Yep.
That he wrote in the 80s, which is, it's might be my favorite comic. I think it's great.
Mm-hmm.
But again, he's got such disdain for the top two comic companies now that when they did that, he requested not to have his name put on it.
Yep.
So it's actually credited to, quote, the original writer.
Yeah. Right.
Not with no name. Yeah. So whereas the second half of the story written by Neil Gaiman, I'm pretty sure it's the things I've seen have been like Neil Gaiman's Miracle Man.
Just the billboard just has his name glowing in 50-foot letters.
Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Uh-huh.
We're here to talk about The Prisoner. And this episode, Living in Harmony, is, again, much like Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, which we covered last time.
Which you mentioned getting titles confused. I could, a year from now, if you asked me Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, I might say it was this episode just because that sounds like a Western-y title.
No, that would make more sense, actually, because we, as we talked about last time, Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling comes from a line from the theme song to the movie High Noon, which is one of the most iconic Westerns ever created.
Yep.
So that makes a lot more sense. And the plot of that episode feels like it's more suited to the title A Change of Mind.
Yes.
Which,
which,
you know, I don't know.
You just bump
and you know what?
Back.
Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, A Change of Mind should have been called Living in Harmony because the whole point of that episode is being disharmonious and unmutual. So forget changing the order you watch them in. I'm changing the titles.
Maybe the order was just determined by people dropped like the stack of index cards with the titles on and they're like, oh, shit, this episode is called this.
Welcome to Harmony, stranger.
Harmony? Never heard of it.
Not many people have, senor. It's sort of exclusive.
So am I. Where is this town?
You'll find out, senor. It's not wise to ask too many questions here.
Anyway, so we've got another departure from the standard format, but kind of not. Which we will get into because this episode, front to back, well, with the exception of the last like 5 minutes, is just a straight Western.
I'd call it a surreal Western.
Yeah, it's a surreal Western, but it's a Western.
It looks like a Western. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
It was a little bit of trivia. It is the it was the first Western ever produced by British. The first Western ever produced in Britain.
Yep.
Which they took
a lot
of... They
did a good job.
Yeah, no, they did great.
It looks like it's the American West.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that a little bit when we get to... I want to talk about David Tomlin a little bit and stuff. But this episode's number two was played by a guy named David Bauer and features another character named The Kid, who we later find out as it to be number eight. Played by an actor named Alexis Kanner, who very strangely gets a box around his name in the opening titles. And I think it's well-deserved, because from what I've read, basically, McGoohan came across this guy, Alexis Kanner, and was just really enamored with him and thought he was a great actor. So I believe he is in... This episode, yeah, he's in the final three. He's in this episode, he's in the next week's, which is, I should say he was in the final three produced. So he's in this episode, he was in The Girl Who Was Death, and he's also in Fallout. So he, I guess McGoohan just really liked this guy. And
yeah, subtext.
Yeah. you just won't be happy until we find out that...
Until we dig up his corpse and make sure... No, it's go ahead. He's an interesting actor.
Yeah, I mean, he is by far, I think, the most interesting non-number two character we've seen in the show.
Yep.
I think his acting is great. I should say his acting is great for 60s television. Not that it's bad, but you know what I mean? He's a little bit, he seems to be kind of in the same vein as McGoohan, where he's kind of theatrical.
Yeah, they're broad.
Yeah, very broad. He does a lot with nothing, really, because he's got no lines until the end, because his character's a mute.
Yep.
And he's very menacing. There's a lot of shots of him where he's legit scary.
Yep.
And which is something I don't think they've ever really managed to do to this point.
Right.
But so the summary of this episode, much like last week, we have a different opening where this time there's no cold opening. But what they actually do is right from the start, you get nothing from the original credits that we've seen up to this point. You don't get the Lotus. You don't get the resignation scene. But you kind of do, actually. Because what they do is they reshoot the resignation sequence, but they do it as a Western. So it starts with McGoohan riding a horse like over the hill with the sun at his back and throwing his sheriff's badge on the table in front of, you know, basically the Western equivalent of George Markstein in the credits.
Yep.
And, you know, riding off into the sunset. And then we get technically the earliest
gratuitous
of the entire series, because in the opening credits, he gets the shit kicked out of him.
Yes. This episode probably has the most fighting out of any of the shows.
Yeah. It is... Yeah, it's by far the most violent.
Yeah.
Definitely. Which is interesting, given the theme of the episode.
Yes, which is non-violent,
yes.
Sort of.
But yeah, the ass beating kind of takes the place of the gassing, even though it'd be kind of funny if it was the Old West and he still got gassed. that'd kind of give the game away, though.
Is like make him eat like a peyote or something. Yeah. Just like eat this.
And, you know, he wakes up in this town called Harmony. And from that point, we're given a pretty, you know, fairly standard Western plot where, he's this sheriff who is resigned his position.
What's the Eastwood Western? Unforgiven.
Yeah,
it's Unforgiven.
Yeah, it's very similar to Unforgiven. Yeah. It's kinda.
Well, it's a guy who doesn't want the role. Like they're like, yeah. You need to be the sheriff. He's like, I'm
well, it's
done
actually
being
closer
the sheriff.
To Tombstone, because Tombstone is all about Wyatt.
Oh, I guess
Earp,
that's true. Yeah,
Wyatt Earp not wanting to. The end is like Unforgiven.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is fucking great.
Yeah. So it's basically you combine the two. Best Westerns,
yeah,
which are best for the different reasons, but you combine the corniness of Tombstone with the
Tombstone's so good
with the death with the finale of Unforgiven.
William Money just kicking ass. I think it's William Money. Anyway, so it's a pretty standard story about a sheriff who has resigned his post, waking up in this. He arrives in this town called Harmony that is without a sheriff and without law, but. The weird thing is, it's run by this character named the Judge, who seems to be, who is a menacing character, but for reasons that I don't really know. I mean, if you're looking, I mean, I know from a prisoner standpoint, but I don't really know from like a Western story standpoint why the Judge wants
Six
to be the sheriff of this town, because... It's, you know, I mean, theoretically, it would just mean him cleaning up the tent. Like, it's not like High Noon where there's these, or I should say, it's not like Tombstone.
Yep.
Where
there's a gang.
It's a lawless place and everybody's going crazy and it has no law and it desperately needs a sheriff.
Right. And, well, the mayor in Tombstone isn't corrupt either. Like,
he's sort of like a
douchebag, but he's not pro lawlessness.
Right, right. But yeah, so the Judge wants Six to be, which is actually a really good cowboy name. That would be a great name for a character in a Western.
Six Shooter.
Yeah, there you go. He wants Six to be the sheriff, but that means taking up the guns, and Six doesn't want to do that. So, because he's resigned. So, through the episode, the Judge... increasingly puts pressure on him to take up this position of being a sheriff, not by doing anything to him, but doing things to the innocent people around.
Yep.
Which then plays on Six's, or I should say Sheriff Six's. this is my friend Sheriff Six. Plays on Sheriff Six's desire to help people, and he's a good man. He doesn't want to see innocent people injured.
Which we've seen before in that one where the woman...
Right.
Yeah, I forget that episode, but the one where the woman is driven to suicide by two.
Right.
And he just wants to get revenge.
Right. So he watches as the mob hangs this showgirl's brother for no reason.
Yep.
And then I can't remember the exact chain of events, but he sets off the kid who is this mute like enforcer, like weirdo with the fastest gun in the West kind of guy, but he's kind of like messed up in the head.
He wears a top hat.
Yeah, he is basically a rapist. And
and just a murderer. Like he gets into duels with people over nothing.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah, I really like that duel scene too, because it was. Well, we could talk about it in a bit, but so then he starts. The judge starts angling his aggression towards the showgirl, putting her in jail, and then putting her in the same room with the kid, and threatening to hurt her, and escalating to the point where Six has no choice but to pick the gun back up and go and kick some ass. But like these stories tend to do, at one point, Six does agree to be the sheriff in order to stop this stuff, but the judge doesn't just want him to be the sheriff. He wants him to be the sheriff with a gun, because Six will not use a gun.
Yep.
He refuses to use a gun. And he keeps pushing, and finally he breaks him and makes him pick up the gun and use the gun to go kick some ass. But as these stories usually do, before he does that, he takes off the badge and throws it down.
Yeah.
And then he gets into a quick draw with the kid and ices him, and basically goes in Unforgiven style into the bar and just like fucks everybody up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but then at the end, he gets shot by the judge, and him getting shot like freaks him out. And we pull back, and it's actually the village, and he's got like this headset on.
Yeah, he's listening to a Walkman.
Yeah, basically. It's the whole thing has been this like virtual reality thing that they've been. It's been the whole thing obviously has been a plot by the village to.
Yeah, not virtual reality, because he's in a town with cardboard cutouts for all the people, but this town is right next to the village. Like he has to just walk down the street, and he's basically back.
Yeah,
to where
it's
he is.
Undefined exactly what the method is.
Yep.
But it is some sort of,
mean the way to get them into his brain, like to experience this.
Yeah. It's some sort of altered reality thing, which he then realizes this Western village, which does exist, is right on the edge of the regular village, like you said.
Yeah.
And man, I love it when he wakes up, and he's like trying to figure out what's going on, and then in the distance you can hear the village music.
Yep.
And that's and so he makes his way to number two's office, and he opens the door and he sees the judge, who is number two, and the kid, who is number eight, and the showgirl, whose name is Kathy, who is also in there, part of this plot. And he doesn't say anything and he just leaves. I really wish they had ended the episode there, because that would have been a great ending. Where, let me rephrase that. That bit goes longer in that room where they start talking about like what was going on.
Two and eight, and the girls start talking.
Which I kind of wish that they hadn't done that, because that scene of him walking in silently, seeing those three people there, and then silently turning around and leaving says everything you need to know about what just happened.
Yeah, I sort of disagree.
Okay.
Just because the acting in that scene was some of the best acting that's happened on the show.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed, they have a very clear cut discussion about what they're doing.
Right.
After Six leaves. And I appreciated it. And I thought the scene was well done in that, their interactions with each other aren't, they're not like underlings. Like it, yeah. It felt very modern in the way that they were interacting with each other, and like sort of like one of them's getting upset that the others aren't doing what needs to be done. The,
right.
the others aren't sort of fearful of the position. They're just like, we'll get it done when it gets done.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it.
Isolate him. Make him kill. Then face him with death. He'll crack. Break him, even in his mind, and the rest will be easy. I should never have listened to you.
It would have worked if you had kept your head and not created the crisis too soon.
How could I control it? Tell me that. You said yourself we would get involved and do what we would in the real situation.
Well, then don't blame my methods, just your own darn lack of self-control.
So the reason I do like that, the dialogue, though, is because it sets up this really interesting concept that they've never they've never played with before, which is that whatever they were doing to alter the reality for Six, the reason that they screwed up is because it became number two and number eight, or like their reality started to bleed together.
Yes.
So their actual persona started to come out in the virtual persona.
Yep.
And basically, that whatever mind fuckery they were doing to Six is messing with them too.
Yep.
Which I really liked.
Yep.
And which leads into this final scene, which I like the idea, but I don't really like the way it's executed, where Kathy ends up back in this Western town, kind of like, basically everything she experienced in the virtual reality, she experienced for real.
Yep.
So she's back there kind of looking over the saloon, and number eight is there as well. And he's has the same thing happening where this twisted psycho killer is now like in his brain.
Yes.
So much like he does in the virtual reality, he kills Kathy.
Yep.
And then two and six show up right as it happens, and eight freaks out and he runs upstairs and he says, "You'll never take me alive," or something. Yeah. And then he jumps off a balcony and
yeah,
kills.
Takes a header off the yeah, balcony.
Takes a header off of like maybe a 12-foot balcony.
Yeah, he should have gone a little bit yeah. higher.
Or like should have shot himself or something. I don't know. But it, the way he fell, it looked like he just probably would have bruised his back yeah. a little bit. But and so, you know, this is the first time where we see the village's actions kind of backfiring and having dire consequences to the members of the village ward,
yes.
you know, the people controlling.
Yep.
And that's basically the end of the episode. Yeah. So what did you think?
This is the best episode of the show so yeah. far.
Interesting. I say interesting mainly because I was watching it again last night. I love it.
Yeah.
I think it's great. And unfortunately, it's like the second lowest rated episode on IMDb. Behind
oh, really?
Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling.
No, this yeah. is by far the best episode. It's the first big thing that it does for me is it elevates McGoohan for me.
Yeah.
Where,
because of his sweet American accent.
Because of his sweet American strut and corduroys.
Get some good McGoohan running. Like that scene later when he's back in the village and he's running towards the camera. Well, and he does that weird like...
He does his Tyrannosaurus yeah. run where he's got like little arms. But
His I don't know what's going on run.
Where he's like tumbling into yeah. like railings and sort of hanging over them. But what I'm saying is that his run as Six...
Mm-hmm.
is an act, because Cowboy Six doesn't run like that.
Right.
And it's fascinating to me because I am a little bit annoyed by the way he plays Six in the village.
Okay.
I find him to be a little bit grating.
Yeah.
And it's like I have a hard time enjoying him when he's around as that persona. And I was sort of thinking, because I'm not too familiar with McGoohan, that was just McGoohan sort of playing himself in
yeah.
these roles. And he's clearly playing a part, because
right.
his Cowboy Six is a much cooler character
mm.
than Six the spy is. The way he talks and the way he interacts with things.
You mean cooler like the definition of cool, where he's just like calm, or cool as in like awesome?
Both.
Okay. Because I would say I prefer Village Six just because he's so different. I mean,
yep.
you don't. There is no other character on TV like Number Six,
right?
Whereas Sheriff Six is kind of, you know, he's pretty standard Western guy, but he's good. I mean, I'm not taking anything away. I think
yep.
he's great, but
I think that Sheriff Six by being calmer allows you to see the symbolism more easily.
Yeah.
Where crazy hectic six is sort of distracting from what's going on. And I liked this one because it doesn't hit you over the head with what's going on. The symbolism is really nice.
Yeah.
Like everything works.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see this plot that the Village has done is by far the most non sort of cheesy 60s thing where you're like, the other episodes have been like, we're going to take his brain out. And this one doesn't do that. It
right.
just you're just put in a world where that's essentially what they've done. They've stuck him into like his brain into a virtual reality machine.
Right.
But it doesn't focus on the technology of what's going on. It just shows you him in this universe.
Yeah.
Which is much, much better than being too sci-fi 60s about it.
Right, right. Yeah, I think I don't... How do I say this? I don't think you can have this episode unless you've done 13 episodes of this show before it. Because what I love about this episode that I didn't really notice until last night is that this episode is basically a one-hour retelling of the entire show.
Yep.
From the resignation to kind of an undefined motivation for the villain.
Yep.
Well, I guess not undefined, but like the reasons behind it are kind of gray. To watching as this villain progressively escalates what they're doing and how harsh they're being to get the result they want.
Yep.
And to the point, I mean, it'll be interesting to see, I don't know if we should talk about this now until we get to the end of the show, but the way the show ends is not entirely dissimilar to the way this episode ends.
Yep.
I don't mean literally, but there's like, you could go back and say like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, this episode has a natural progression that when you get to the end of the show, the end of the series, it doesn't not have the same progression.
Right.
It's a lot more weird and surreal.
Sure.
But yeah, it looks fantastic.
Yeah.
It's directed by David Tomlin, who has not directed... I wish he had directed every episode.
Yeah.
I mean, it's shot like a Western. The lighting is great.
Yep.
And it's not surprising to me to learn that David Tomlin became one of the great assistant directors in Hollywood. After the show, he went on to... He was the assistant director for Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi and the Temple of Doom and Last Crusade. He was big with Spielberg and Lucas.
Yep.
And I mean, he's good. I don't know how much of the story he stole from the other guy, but it's a well-written episode.
Yeah.
There's great stuff in this episode.
The people of Harmony against Katherine Johnson. The accused, step forward. You're accused of aiding a prisoner to escape. How do you plead?
But Judge, you just said he warned a criminal. He was being held in protective custody.
She didn't know that.
The scene where, early on in the episode, Kathy, the showgirl, helps Six escape from his little prison cell where he's not a prisoner. He's being held there for his own protection.
Yep.
But Kathy comes in and dopes up the kid so she can get the key to the cell, which she slips to Six, and he gets out of there. But he gets dragged back, much like Rover would drag him back.
Yep.
And they arrest Kathy and put her on trial for aiding and abetting the escaped prisoner.
Yep.
And during the trial, the judge says, oh, Six, well, he doesn't say Six, but... Sheriff, you don't have to worry about it. You weren't being held as a prisoner. You're free to go.
Yeah. And escaping isn't breaking the law because you're not actually a prisoner.
Right, right. And so, but then they bring in Kathy and put her on trial for aiding and abetting an escaped prisoner. And one of the townspeople says, well, wait, you just said he wasn't a prisoner. Then why is she on trial? And he says, she didn't know that.
Yep.
And that's just like, whoa. I mean, I don't know if it's the delivery or what, but that's cold as ice, man. But his delivery. Paradise. What's that?
Paradise, singing that song.
Yeah.
Paradise. No, it's I think I know what you're going to say. I didn't mean to interrupt, but the Western setting grounds the ideas of the village in a way that's realistic.
Yeah.
You know, which is nice. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem highfalutin. Like sometimes I feel the village, the way that, like I brought this up before, the way the characters dress and the way it's like, it's very odd.
Yeah.
It's a little bit distracting from what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel it lessens the impact, where if you have this Western setting, which feels much more realistic, even though it is pretty surreal, it's much more of a relatable, and you're able to track what the theme they're talking about is. Like, yeah. You don't get confused about how, oh, that's just the village exerting its sort of weird laws over people.
Mm.
You get a good, realistic example of how unfair the village is being, which you don't really get in the other things, because things are so wacky that you assume that there is no law.
Yeah, sort and you've also got this, like, multi-layered control where it's like, well, who's working for who, and, you know, is this guy really...
Right.
Who's running the village, and whereas in this one, you've got, it's... I mean, it's simpler, but not in, like a dumb way. You know what I mean? Like, it's not...
The simpleness adds to the gravitas, like, if you want to call it that. Like, you're not confused by people's relationships. You understand... The judge runs the town.
Yep.
He controls the mob.
Yep.
And he wants Six to be on his side.
Yeah, but and I don't think... I mean, I think you could criticize it for taking the concept of the show, which is pretty gray, generally,
mm-hmm.
and distilling it down to something that is pretty black and white. But I don't think that you lose anything.
No.
Like, I think it... Like you said, I think it arguably works better.
Yeah, I think it does.
Especially... You know, I like it being so late in the run, too, because it kind of, it's sort of, if it were me, I would put this episode right before the last two. Not to jump way ahead, but this would be...
Isn't that where it is now?
We've got one more. We've got The Girl Who Is Death, and then we have Once Upon a Time and Fallout.
Oh, Fallout.
Which is a two-parter. But I would put Living in Harmony right before the end, because... The end is very... The last two episodes are very... Well, the first half is very specific in what it's doing. Well, I guess they're both very specific, but they're very intense.
Yep.
And it's very much like a... This is the crescendo of the show.
Sure.
And having Living in Harmony be the preamble to that is a great way to restate the show.
Yep.
And very succinctly. And... re-emphasize Six's character before you head into the final push.
Sure.
Not my kind of town.
It's a good town.
Enjoy it.
Why? What's wrong with our town, mister?
Maybe I don't like the way it's run.
Oh, you just do as the judge says. He'll look after you.
I look after myself.
Last week we were talking about Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling. And we both mentioned that there are some similarities between what they tried to do.
Yep.
Now, I assume you think that Living in Harmony did it better.
Yeah, it did much better.
So what do you think, why do you think that is? Why do you think that this one works better than the other one? Aside from the fact that it has Patrick McGoohan in it.
Why this one works better?
Yeah.
Because this one stays away from the hokey sci-fi plot of brain switching.
Yeah.
The problem with the other one is that I think the similarities between the two, I guess, is where I'll start. The similarities is that the show in these past two episodes has started taking a much bigger look at things mm-hmm. than sort of being narrowly focused on Six and his experience with stuff.
Yeah.
He's much more passive, or at least he's much more of like an actor in the events that go on than he is driving things.
Yep.
And that allows... That allows the village to seem much clearer in what it's doing.
Mm.
The other one doesn't work because it doesn't quite get both feet out of the boat. You're like it's straddling lines. It's trying to be like the old show while also exploring this whole new thing that's much more surreal than 'cause I know the show is described as surreal. I don't think all the episodes are surreal as much as they are just odd, yeah. sort of. Like, mm-hmm. there's a difference between... this. Is, the Western episode is much more surreal than anything they've done before.
Right.
And they made it a tone instead of just sort of a, look at how wacky all this stuff is,
right.
kind of.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that because it's much more... that impacts the story as opposed to just being dressing on the story.
Yeah.
And the story here is much more... A, I could track it easily, which is something the prisoner occasionally has trouble doing. I understood everything that was going on.
Right.
Everything was very clear. The symbolism was very clear. And the ending was fine. I'd have a suggestion about how to fix it, but I thought that the ending made sense in terms of what had actually gone on before it.
Yeah. And no, I would agree with all that. I also think... I also think that just from a technical standpoint, if what they were trying to do in these two episodes was a way to continue the core of the core idea of the series, but get it outside of the village.
Yes.
I think this episode does it way better because you're getting outside the claustrophobic nature of the village itself, but you're not sacrificing theme. You're not sacrificing, you know, character.
Yeah.
Whereas Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling does both, you know, does both of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how the series ends, but I could see if you, because I like this episode a lot and I would continue it sort of the way that it does it. If he escapes, it's a little bit cliche. I don't know if this would have been this time, but if he escapes and he moves back into the world and is, it's distressing how similar to the village real life can be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of, it's the first, since his eyes have been open to it through the village, he is much more noticeable of these things when he's back in real world.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would have been interesting.
Mm.
Anything like that. But yeah, I just like the... and the episodes where he doesn't talk as much seem to be better. Because what's the other one where he doesn't talk?
Many Happy Returns.
Many Happy Returns is probably the second best episode. This one...
you know, it's interesting because I was doing some reading online last night. And there's some thread on the message boards on IMDb where they have some sort of, I don't know what, where they're getting the numbers for this, but they're doing some sort of ranking of episodes and stuff.
Sure. Just users voting. Probably.
I guess. Yep. I don't know. I didn't really bother to figure out exactly what they were doing because it was late. and I had already been down the rabbit hole for a long time trying to find stuff about these episodes.
Yep.
But, and they have, the highest percentage of people, or I should say the highest rated episodes among people were A, B, and C and Schizoid Man and I think Chimes of Big Ben, which I understand, but I don't agree with.
Yeah.
Because I would agree more with you, where I would say that as far as just very well executed episodes with good ideas.
Yep.
This is way up there.
Yes.
And Many Happy Returns is way up there. You know, as we've gotten, I mean, maybe we can touch on this stuff more when we do our, you know, recap. But it's interesting that this episode gets so overlooked. At least judging by how it's rated on IMDb, it's, you know, basically the same rating as Do Not Forsake Me, and it's just, it's so good.
Yeah. I don't understand.
Like when this episode was over, I was thinking to myself, man, why don't I watch this one all the time? It's so fun. I mean, it's fun. Yep. It's good. It's, you know, well shot. It's, I don't know. It's
like fight scenes galore.
Yeah. Oh man. Like the gunfights are cool.
Yeah.
First of all, adding to all of the awesome shit that Six can do, not only is he the fastest gun in the West, but he gets shot in the face and doesn't even flinch.
No, yeah. Shot in the hand and doesn't even take his hand off his whiskey glass. Yeah. He's just like, whatever.
Which is, you know, which is an awesome bit of Western badassery to put in there.
I mean, to tie into it, this is the only episode where I felt that he has had an equal as a foil.
Yes.
In the kid.
Well, yeah, I would agree to a certain extent. I may be biased because Once Upon a Time, the second to last episode, is basically just a battle of wits between Six and Number Two. and it's the number two from Chimes of Big Ben, who I always thought was like they were the closest to being on the same level.
Yeah.
And so having them two pitted against each other directly really emphasizes that.
Yeah.
But aside from that, I would definitely agree. The kid is he's very much like the opposite of Six. Where yes. he's you know, he's dangerous, he's violent, he's silent.
He's more emotional. He yeah, responds to everything.
Much more emotional, yeah.
He's good. Sensitive. But one of the best. He's mean.
We've got plenty of those.
I could use some more.
The kid really stood out to me in this episode, more so than I think when I've watched it in the past. I think probably because I was paying more attention. But Alexis Kanter's acting is just really good. Like, yeah. That first scene with him, I think it's the first scene where he, like, falls over or something, and he gets back up, and he puts his top hat on, and he does this weird, like, he doesn't just put the hat on, he kind of, like, curls it back onto his head.
Yep.
And right there, I was like, oh, shit, this guy's actually acting. He's not just saying the lines.
Yes,
you know, where you have someone like Darren Nesbitt, who was the blonde number two, talking about how I didn't know what was going on, so I just, you know, I just played him like I didn't know what was going on, and I just read my lines. It's like the polar opposite of that is Alexis Kanter, who has no lines.
Yes.
And is just so on the same page of like, yeah, this is kind of a weird show, I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's really good.
Yeah, he is. He's, he is... Yeah, the most effective actor at conveying sort of what he's supposed to be, which is intimidating. That does, because I think the problem is Six is in the past. A lot of his nemesis have been sort of chatty Cathys. Like Six is sort of a chatty Cathy. It's based on being witty against each other.
Yeah.
So this guy is, he's more, we were joking before, but he's more the Bane role.
Yeah, he actually is. Now that I think about it. Yeah, you're right.
So it's
he is the first person he's come in contact with who is
a fighter.
Who is a fighter and who is legitimately violent.
Yes.
You know, it's always gabbity gabbity, I'm a little bit smarter than you are. But this guy, the kid is just a fucking maniac.
Right. Yep. And I think that's why he's interesting. And he's a good physical actor.
Yeah.
Which is maybe easier to focus on when you don't have lines, because that's all you have to think about.
Yeah.
But he breaks away from the theatrical stoicness that the previous actors have been on, which is both a thing of the times and sort of a British.
And his cost, I really like his costume too. His costume is like a great, his costume just in general is like a great, change of pace for the episode. The episode is fairly, being a Western, it's fairly drab, but his episode, his costume, he's got that salmon-colored shirt and those, like, stirrups in that top hat, and he's got that, you know...
Red hair,
and he just pops among everybody else, and he really stands out.
Yeah.
And I love the little bits that they give him to do, like, as I mentioned briefly before, that gunfight in the saloon, where...
Against the little dorky guy that sort of offended him.
There's a drunk in the bar who I can't remember exactly what he does, but he offends him.
He talks to Kathy. He touches Kathy.
Because the kid has this
crush on her or something.
Unhealthy crush on her.
Yep.
And her heaving bosoms, which which McGoohan did not care for.
No, he just
no. Seriously, he actually apparently asked.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he apparently asked for the, once he saw the costume, he was like, "Can there any way we can like cover her tits with shadow?" He's whatever, man. I still love the guy, even though he's kind of a weirdo.
He's like, we need more bullets. We need more gunfights, and get rid of those titties.
So anyway, so he's the kid. This guy crosses the line with the kid.
Yeah,
and he kind of backs off and gets in like gunfighter pose.
Yeah,
and everybody seems to know that this guy is that the kid is the shit. He's like the fastest gun, right? So. The drunk guy is like shaking, and he goes for his gun.
Well, he's sort of got a is this fucking guy serious kind of look. Like it's a lot of like over the shoulder. Like is this actually happening right now?
And you know, because he knows that there's no way he's gonna beat this guy.
Yeah.
And so the drunk guy goes for his gun, and the kid doesn't pull his gun. the drunk pulls his gun, and instead of shooting him, he kind of like freezes because he can't believe that he beat him to the punch.
Okay, yeah. I guess I was unclear. I thought did he not pull the trigger?
I don't think he did.
Okay.
I missed it. I thought the way I read it was he pulled the gun and then he kind of like...
shocked that it actually...
Yeah, he was shocked that he beat him. And in doing that, the kid then pulls his gun and shoots him.
Yep.
Which then gives him the self-defense angle because the drunk guy technically drew first.
Right, yes.
So, which is a nice little beat, but just that beat of not pulling the gun and using that as a tactic because it like totally psychs the other guy out is really cool. I like that a lot.
Yeah, I interpreted it as that was our first clue that this was not reality. It's sort of like a Matrix failsafe where this guy can't die. So even when this guy pulls his gun in this world, it's not going to work. And the other guy, that's why he's better than them.
Yeah, I guess that wouldn't really work though because then the kid kills Kathy later on. So
yes,
I mean technically those three wouldn't be able to. So yeah, I'd have to watch it again, but I'm pretty sure he doesn't.
Yeah, pull the trigger. I'm not sure either way. That's
yeah. Well, anyway, but regardless, it's a good beat.
Yep, yep.
And yeah, I like it. I like it when they. I think they escalate him really well. You know, he's a drunk. He's a very handsy drunk.
Yeah,
and his. You know, he's just the most violent character they've seen in the show because he's, I don't think he actively, like, rapes Kathy, but he definitely tries to.
Yes, I think
and
so.
Is that, I just watched this last night and I can't remember exactly how it goes, but is that what leads him to kill her? Like, he tries to go at her and she pushes him off and then he kind of breaks and
right and he strangles her. I'm pretty sure that's how it works.
And yeah, that's the most twisted character they've had on the show by far.
Yep. Yep.
A
lot of death in this one.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's sort of not real. Well, at the end it eventually is, but people die a couple times in the lynching scene.
Yeah,
it's kind of a cool camera
they hang
work.
That dude.
Yeah, they put the noose around the camera, which was an interesting.
Yeah, it's a first person mob lynching, which is interesting.
Yep.
And
then the scene where, I like to win a shot when the kid is confronting Kathy. They do the back and forth between them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was cool. It was like an interesting. It's sort of like the camera's the perspective of each character as they're looking at the other characters. They're like stumbling around, and it was nice.
What really feels. What I think really comes through with this episode is that the production team is having a lot of fun.
Yep.
I think I had been reading that around the time of Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, where McGoohan takes off and goes and shoots Ice Station Zebra. I think he was starting to get burnt out.
Yep.
And I mean, if the stories are true about him freaking out on set and having a meltdown and stuff, I'm sure going away for however many weeks he was shooting that show.
It's a nice break.
Yeah, cleansed the palate a little bit, and then they came back and they're shooting a Western.
Right.
You know, the genesis of this episode was that they really wanted to do a Western, and McGoohan had never done a Western before. Why not do a Western? We can fudge it and make it part of the village, which is great. Which is another thing I love about the concept of the show is you can do anything with it. You could make it any genre you wanted and it would fit.
Right. And I don't think the show does enough of that is the problem.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like why Batman is my favorite comic book character because his core concept is so sound that you could put him into literally any situation or any kind of story and it still works.
Right.
You know, you could have a crime story, you could have a sci-fi story, you could have a horror story, and it all works because the character of Batman is so malleable and works in so many different ways.
Yep. Yep.
But yeah, so when he comes back, I'm sure having Markstein not there was probably great for him too.
Yep.
Because it's just another person not nagging him.
Right.
To make the show. I'm sure Markstein would have probably hated this episode.
Probably. Well, it's totally unlike any of the other.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he's working with Alexis Kanner, which he clearly liked, who he clearly liked. And it feels like they're just having a good time. Yep. And it really shows because the camera work is really interesting. The lighting is fantastic.
Yep.
I mean, it's really... On my website, eatdeadmeat.com, we have these short videos that we shoot that are kind of companion pieces to the comic book that I do, which, Wes, you've helped out on a couple before.
Yep.
And some of the most fun we have is trying to ape certain styles of other films and stuff. Like, there's one that we had that we shot that was entirely, like, meant to be like a... shit, what the hell's the name of the guy who did The Thin Red Line?
The director?
Yeah, Malick.
Okay.
There's one that we did that's...
Oh, Terrence Malick, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. There's one that we did that was... We were kind of trying to ape the Terrence Malick thing of the really drawn-out, long, wispy shots
slow
and stuff.
Slow motion with, yeah, like, yeah. Sort of dramatic music in the background.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun to do that. And I think they were probably having that same kind of fun in this because all of these guys grew up on Westerns and they really wanted to do it. So getting the chance to do it, they were just pulling out all the tricks that they could find.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, we got these hats. We can light these hats. Awesome. And, you know, we've got the bar scene and we can have guys falling through things and shooting them off the ledges and stuff.
Yeah.
Just sliding the gun down the bar. It's like everything you've ever wanted to do as a kid in a Western, they do in this episode.
Yeah. Our Westerns are probably the only pure American film style.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Probably. I can't think of anything else that would be comparable. Yeah, but they're very easy just because they're so hero-based.
Yeah.
You know, everything is about the hero. The interesting thing about Westerns is how what kind of hero the hero is, it determines what kind of story that you tell.
Yeah. They are inherently mythic.
Right, yeah.
And I think that's why they become so popular outside of the United States. Because I'm sure I don't watch a ton of... I mean, I don't... Well, I was going to say, I'm sure there are other cultures that have certain styles of film that are native to... And purely native to whatever culture they have.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
doesn't work as well in translation.
Yep.
But I think one of the reasons why the Western does work so well in translation across the world is because it is a very, like I said, inherently mythic, and it's so open to character archetypes and themes you can play with, and it's just having something like that, like The Prisoner itself or, you know, Batman or whatever, is really, it makes it spread out much easier because you can find something that you identify with,
yep.
that you enjoy,
yep.
and you can latch onto that. I mean, that's how you get the Sergio Leone movies that are based on samurai films.
Yep.
Because there's something... There's a certain line of logic drawn between those two styles where you can kind of cross them together.
Yeah, yeah.
And they work really well.
Yeah, no, that's, yeah, it's a very very malleable form.
Which we'll be expanding on in our Deadwood podcast.
And our Batman as a Western.
Batman as a Western podcast. Batman as a Samurai Western podcast.
But enough of that. We don't want to start off on the wrong foot. You grow to like this job. It's most rewarding. Now, Sheriff, you won't regret joining my outfit.
You may.
You're just sore for the moment. Here, put this on. You'll feel better. Nothing but the best.
I agreed to wear the badge, but not the gun.
It's a start.
So, do you think that Sheriff Six, I think we touched on this a little bit. Do you think that Sheriff Six is a direct analog to Village Six? Because Sheriff Six feels more, he's more of a classic Western hero here. He's more of the guy who's trying to do right, who is going to save the woman in peril or the person in peril. Whereas Six seems a lot more gray, even though he seems to still have that core of the loner with a conscience.
Yep.
The Western version seems a lot more dialed into that.
Yes. It's funny how we were talking about in "Oh my darling, don't forsake me," or whatever. One of the glaring flaws is that the guy playing Six does not copy his mannerisms, and it's distracting. Here, I don't think he's a direct analog. He's sort of a different character. Like his personality, he has the same sort of backbone, but his whole mannerism is different as the Western guy. Yeah. He's playing the cool cowboy who doesn't speak much, doesn't get overly emotional except when he needs to do in the final scene where he's just going to kill everybody.
Right.
You know, he just kind of wants to be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is as good a point now as ever to bring up how I'd fix the ending.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Because if you want to keep him this way...
Zoom out. We're in a snow globe.
Shake it up, yeah. Rosebud. This was the one show that I would have been improved by having him wake up and it's a dream sequence.
Well, it kind of is, though.
But not real... Like, because the... I mean, two is causing this to happen. Yeah. I wish that hadn't happened.
Okay.
And I wish that he was just dreaming about this situation and he wakes up and sort of he runs into 2 and 8 and they come into his room or whatever to talk to him and then the episode just ends there.
Okay.
Because if it's a dream sequence, it makes sense why he's slightly different because in your dreams, you're sort of a different, you can be a different version of yourself and that would make sense why he's acting this way. And also because it would show that the village has sort of seeped into him at this point, and his dreams are now a reflection of everything that goes on in the village.
That's interesting.
And instead of, like, I was a little bit disappointed where it's just like, oh, it's just two doing a little bit of a thing, which you kind of know it is. That's what is going to be happening. But it would have been cool if it was nothing to do with them and it's just Six internalizing it.
That's interesting. Yeah, I like that. I guess it's tough for me to get past the it was all a dream thing because it's such an overdone thing.
So, but I think if they had done it, I would have been upset too.
I see what you're saying, though. Yeah, if there was a more elegant way to do that same idea, that's pretty cool, actually. Mm-hmm. Because all of the village stuff has been pushed upon him.
Right.
So to have him actually manifest it himself would actually be pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I like that.
He's dreaming of being the hero in his own story, which is an interesting little thing. It's just that's my only. And it's not even that I dislike the ending. It feels a little bit like odd. Even though I love the ending scene with those 2 and 8 and whatever the Kathy's number is.
Yeah.
I just like the scene between them. It just felt... It went on a little bit too long. Like, you would have said you would have ended it right when he turns around and left.
Yeah.
Six walked out of there.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. Yes, because I think at this point you could get away with doing a silent thing like that because you don't need to say anything. You know...
Right. And the whole episode's been largely silent.
And that reaction... I mean, Six's reaction without any words is just great. You know, he just like gives him that glare... They kind of look back at him, and then he just turns around.
I just thought it was a little bit weird. Like, for my dream idea, it would make sense that he's dreaming about them as they come in. I'm a little surprised that in the version that they have, he's surprised that they are two and a minion of two.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that seems a little bit... After you wake up in this area, and it's right next to the village, you should immediately just be like, I bet two was up to something.
Yeah.
Yeah, there they are.
Well, they're he surprised? I kind of read it as he was going there just to confirm it.
I read it as was going to confirm, and he was disappointed that that's actually what it was. Right.
Yeah, because I guess my reading was he goes there to confirm it, and he, like, just to walk in and be like, what's the best example? But, you know, like just to give the kind of, like, I know what you're doing kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's...
Right.
Not that he needs to prove it to himself that it was them. It's like he walks in and just, like, looks at them and is like,
To let them know that he's in?
Yeah, just like, you assholes.
Oh, because I kind of got a sadness to his leaving. Like, he was sort of... I'd have to watch it again. Maybe I was just reading into it. But I got sort of the Charlie Brown turnaround with, like, his head down and, like, he walked out. Either way, I don't mind the ending. I think it's fine. I just that would be my one improvement for what I would do.
Well, when I talk When I ask if he if Sheriff Six is an analog to Village Six, one of the things that made me think about that was at a certain point he says the judge says something to the effect of I don't know you know there's you know I'm the one in charge. He makes some like vaguely malicious or
yep.
thing, and then Six responds with, "That's one of the reasons why I'm staying." Like, that's the point where he's taken up the sheriff
yep.
position. Yep. And it made me think, is that also then a expanding on Six's mindset at this time? We can talk about this in terms of placement in the series, right?
Yeah.
So we've talked about how his arc, the way that we've seen it, has been... basically the 12 steps of grief counseling or whatever it is,
yep.
where it's, you know, goes from anger to rejection to acceptance.
Denial.
He's kind of in the acceptance phase where it's like, all right, this is where I am now. And his, judging by his actions against the village at this point, it seems like he's gone from, I'm going to try and escape to, all right, I'm going to be here, but I'm not going to make it easy for you guys. I'm going to try and, you know, fight you.
Right,
which is kind of, it feels like that's summed up in this scene, which is a very Western scene
mm-hmm.
to be like, you know, I'm gonna be the sheriff. I'm gonna be the guy who goes against you, kind of thing.
Right, I'm not just gonna leave. I'm gonna fix this town.
But in this, in under the umbrella of the village of the prisoner, it feels a lot more not poignant, but it feels a lot more honest to Six's character to be like, oh, this is why he's staying.
Yeah.
This is why he's not trying to escape anymore. And again, it's another reason why I would place this. This is like the breather I would have before you go into the last two.
Yeah, I think this is a very ending episode. And yeah. I think his whole mentality of he's going to stay and fight is he's going to stick it to the village.
Yeah.
Like that's just his representation of it. I do think they should have had a beat where he gets chased out of the village and the kid goes to get him. And he, you know, he meets him at the train station and he tells him, "You tell him I'm coming and hell's coming with me."
You skin that you smoke this, wagon and see what happens. Badge?
It says U.S. Marshal.
I see anybody wearing a top hat, I'm going to gun him down. You tell him I'm coming
and hell's coming with me. And then he just slaps the shit out of Billy Bob Thornton for a couple minutes.
Let it bleed.
Go check out Tombstone People. It's on Netflix.
Oh, it's so good.
It is.
So good. Except for that scene where he runs through the water going, "No!" That's really dumb.
As a billion guys with shotguns are just unloading at him, and "No!"
Yeah.
It is
really stupid.
It is terrific. Porky Russell. I'm thinking, "No."
I would cut that scene out. If you cut that scene out, that movie's practically perfect.
Or just don't put it in slow motion. It's the slow motion that makes it ridiculous.
Yeah, that's true.
If he was just screaming no, like walking through the water, I'd be like, oh, that's better than...
Another parallel between The Prisoner and Tombstone is, I guess, Kurt Russell apparently shadow directed that movie.
Yeah,
They didn't like the director, so they got rid of him and he did it.
Yep.
He should direct more because that movie's... awesome.
Has he not directed more? It feels like he would be the kind of person who would direct.
So. No? Not really.
Oh, interesting.
Featuring the finest performance of Val Kilmer ever put to screen.
Yes. Yes. His Doc Holliday is excellent.
We'll be covering all of this in our Tombstone podcast, which we'll be doing after Deadwood podcast and
20
after
episode our... Tombstone podcast. I do love Tombstone. Last thing I just want to say is it's a cable movie that I can always watch no matter what I'm at.
Always. Always put it on.
The plot is fairly irrelevant to the proceed. It's a very vignette-y. It's like all the scenes are very good.
Yeah.
Overall, I don't think it's I love the movie. It's not a great movie because the plot is kind of a little bit wonky, but the scenes and some of the characters are so strong that it like.
Yeah, stays and I mean, up. You know, it's chock full of great lines.
Yeah, great lines. Yeah.
And Earp and Doc Holliday are great, and it's just so good.
Oh, my darling.
Kurt Russell.
The cowboys are finished. You understand me? I see a red sash. I killed a man wearing it. So run, you cur.
Run! Tell all the other curs the lie's coming. You tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
So how did you feel about the virtual reality element? And we can talk about that going into this ending, the ending beat with where they have you get this first instance of the crazy things that they're doing to people, bleeding into the staff, basically.
Yeah.
Because as I mentioned at the top, after the whole thing breaks down, number eight criticizes number two, because he let too much of his own personality bleed into it. And I think he says, we would get involved and do what we do in the real situation. And they're sort of implying that the reality is getting blurred.
Yep.
And this follows them back into the real world and causes Kathy to develop the feelings for Six that she had in the virtual reality in real life.
Yeah. I feel like that's a plot of a modern movie or something, isn't it? Where if you spend too long in a world, you start to...
It's kind of like Inception a little
bit. Oh, it is sort of like Inception. Yeah. Okay.
And then, of course, the kid, or number eight, starts to develop the tendencies of the kid and just flat out murders Kathy.
Yeah.
But yeah, the execution of that scene at the end is not good. It's weird because, like, the kid chokes Kathy out, but then goes and jumps off the balcony. But then Six comes over, puts Kathy in his arms, and she says something to the effect of, I wish for me it was real, or something like that, and then dies. It's like, I don't know if you could get choked to death and then have a parting line and then die.
He force choked her.
Yeah. I mean, it makes about as much sense as the kid or number eight jumping off a, like, 8-foot balcony.
Yeah, in a very gymnastic way. He sort of did like a the bar move where he just kind of rolled over and just tumbled. Yeah. I don't mind it. I guess their deaths are kind of bad. Mm-hmm. But I think the symbolism is strong enough to overcome the sort of silliness of their deaths.
Yeah, I like the idea. I actually wish they had done an episode that focused on that more.
Because they can't shoot each other, right? Because they're not... There's no guns in the village.
Right.
Yeah, so there's not really... Unless they just go crazy, would have been a stronger ending. You know, like they've been in the world for so long that basically their brain turns to mush or something.
Yeah.
They have to spend their life in the hospital, that little mental hospital that's in the village.
Yeah, I think...
I think this is cleaner, though. I'd rather have them exit.
Yeah, I mean, it's cleaner, but I wish it was just more convincing.
Sure.
I don't mind the actual, like, beats.
Yeah.
But just the way that they execute them is kind of clunky.
You know what I did like about it? Six largely has no impact on how it goes down.
Yeah, yeah.
He's kind of watching it.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
It's refreshing, I think.
Yeah. But yeah, I would have liked to see more of this idea of the tactics of the village folding back in on itself a little bit more and messing with the realities of the people who are implementing this stuff on Six.
Yes.
We've gotten a little bit of that stuff in previous episodes. And I think we're going to get a lot more of it in Once Upon a Time. It's got that kind of feeling to it.
Sure.
In some places.
The cracks are starting to show.
Yeah.
The village methodology.
But it's a good idea. I like the idea of having those tactics kind of like reflect back.
Yep.
It's a shame they couldn't have done. I mean, that's the thing. I think if they had had time to take a breather,
yep,
and come up with some other ideas and expand on some things, they probably could have gotten. I don't know if they could have gotten another 13 episodes out of it, but they could have gotten four or five.
Well, yeah, it's true, because as much as I like the concept of this episode, I wouldn't want to see 13 episodes of this happening endlessly.
No, definitely
so
not.
It's like there's a balance to be made.
Yeah.
It's
so tough because, you know, as much as I love the show, I do feel like, yeah, I mean, you can only go so far with this concept. Like, perfect example of why you don't want to go further with the show Prison Break. I never watched it, but the entire concept of the show is this guy's brother, I believe this is the concept of the show. This guy's brother is in prison wrongfully or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he purposely gets arrested and thrown in jail in the same prison so he can break his brother out of prison, right? Sure. Which, as far as I know, I think they do pretty quickly.
I think they, like, do that in the first season. And yeah. Then the subsequent seasons are like them on the road and the government is using them to
do something. That show went on for like 5 seasons. Yeah. Once you break out of the prison, the show is over.
Yeah.
You don't have, I mean, unless it's like, well, but like, what if it's like a wider prison and like the world is the prison? So it's like, it's not like the prison in Massachusetts, but like all of Massachusetts you have to get out. You know, it's like.
No, it just, all of them need the Shawshank ending, right? You break out of the prison and then you go to your beach or wherever you want to be, and that's pretty much the end of it.
Yeah. Or like 24. I never thought they would get more than a season out of that because it's like, it's such a, it's based on, it's. Hinges on such a clear gimmick that anything, I figured they would do that once and I'd be like, oh, that was really cool. But no, they did that for 9 years or whatever.
Yep,
but,
they did.
But I think The Prisoner is a great example of something where you can't really, you know, even if you had episodes as good as this or Chimes of Big Ben, it's like once you get into like the 15 or 20th time they've done this, it's like, yeah, I get it. He's trying to escape, but he can't escape because there's a big white ball.
Yep. I think that's why I like this episode, because it's not about that. It's using all the constraints of the series without being too much of a retread.
Yeah.
Which is ironic because it is retreading everything that this show is sort of about.
Thematically, it's a huge retread. But I mean,
it feels fresh as opposed to being fresh, which is really what you
need. I think that's another reason why it does it better than Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, because they're changing the structure and they're changing the execution, but they're keeping the themes and the structure, they keep the themes and the ideas the same, but it feels fresh because the environment is different, which is the only way you can continue the show and have it make sense.
Yes, yeah.
Like yourself, for instance.
I'm up for hire.
You turned in your badge?
And my gun.
What were your reasons?
My reasons.
You've already taken the job.
With whom?
So, what would you rate the plan in this one? One more thing.
Sure.
Before we talk about that, I did want to mention that I thought this episode had the most elegant insertion of "Why did you resign?" They don't lean on it, but it's kind of a thread that goes through the whole episode, because, you know, much like the show, the whole series, because this guy doesn't want to pick up his gun. He's been a sheriff. He's resigned. You don't know why. And it's all about trying to break him and get him to go back.
Yep.
And on his, the decisions that he's made.
Yeah.
And,
It's an effective "why did you resign" thing, because the village to this point has never put him in a situation where he would need to admit why he resigned.
Yeah.
And this episode does it through he needs to arm himself to deal with this problem.
Yep.
So he's forced to take action, which in previous episodes he's never been forced. They ask the question and he doesn't answer it and they go, okay.
Yeah.
So that's why this is effective. It's the first time they've made him doubt himself.
And the insertion of, they drop it in very quickly, the actual question, when they first bring him in to the town. The judge is playing cards or something, and he's like, I heard you left something, something. He's like, yeah. And I said, well, why'd you leave? And like, for a second, it seems like Six registers it a little bit, but it's not like the way that it's been in other episodes where it's like, as soon as they say it, it's like, everything is spinning now.
Yeah. A bunch of quick zoom in and outs as the lights flash in the background.
Yeah. They drop it in as dialogue. He doesn't answer it, but like you were saying, the whole episode is kind of about him having to act on that and having to defend it or break his word.
Yep.
Which is really interesting because they've never, like you said, they've never done that to this point.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as the plot, I suppose it's pretty weak, right? It's kind of a cool thing, but I don't know if the two's plot obviously doesn't work.
Yeah.
And not really through any fault of Six. It's basically their idea is bad. I think I'd have to give it a 2.
Yeah, I'd probably agree. I think the problem is is that though it makes for a great episode of the show, it's, again, inversely to Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, where the actual plot of that story makes more sense in that, like, the village wants this technology, and so they send Six out to get the guy who created the technology. Yep. There's an actual, like, you know, these are the beats they have to hit for the story. This one, the plot is kind of irrelevant, and it doesn't, like, the actual plan that they're executing,
yep,
there's no way it can end with, like, constructively.
Yes.
Because there's, you're not actively getting any information out of Six.
Yep.
And, I mean, it's like, you run that program 100 times,
how many times does it work? It seems like a lot of work for very little possible outcome.
Yeah, it's like you run the program 100 times. 100 times, Six, it ends the same way.
Yeah.
Because Six is not going to, I mean, I don't even know what they're trying to do, really.
Right, yeah. It's more symbolic than literal of a plot, you know,
yeah.
Which I think works for the episode. It doesn't work in terms of if you're trying to break down if their plot is good, it doesn't really make sense, but it's more interesting than good.
Yeah, I mean, you could, if you wanted to really rationalize why the actual plot doesn't really make a lot of, it doesn't have a lot of point to it, you could chalk it up to what we talked about in Many Happy Returns, the possibility that they're just testing something.
Yep.
I mean, they could just be testing this program on him.
Yeah, right.
And clearly it backfires on them.
Yep.
Which is kind of interesting. But if, you know, I like that they don't specifically say that. I think, you know, like I've said before in the show, you can get away with a lot just because of the structure of the show.
Yep.
And, you know, you don't have to explain all of this stuff.
Right. Yep.
So, yeah, I would say as far as the plan goes and effectiveness, I'd say as a 2. It's probably, honestly, it's probably the weakest plan they've had.
Yeah, it's up there.
Yeah. Which is ironic because it's probably one of the best episodes.
Yeah, I feel like there was one possibly worse.
Maybe the second half of Change of Mind. Where they give him the fake lobotomy, and you're like, so, now that you're crazy, why did you resign?
Oh, I'd say almost more the one where the guy gives the bomb and the medallion might be a worse plot. That one's kind of silly.
Yeah, including Six. Yeah, yeah.
And that
we
one
already
is,
covered that.
That one, yeah, that one's pure plot. So when
yes.
the plot is bad, it becomes very apparent that this is all very silly.
Right.
Yeah.
Simo's been talking, Sheriff.
Yeah.
You're the only man stood up to the judge, so we're with you.
Yeah.
We'll help you clean up the town.
You're going to help me clean up your town.
We can't do it by ourselves. And Sheriff, neither can you.
So, a little trivia. I mentioned the stuff about the writer and the co-writer. But CBS actually did not show, I mentioned this a little bit, CBS did not show this episode on its initial run when the show first broadcast. Now, it has been debated as to why this is. It's been said that it was because of the overt references to psychedelic drugs. Which I've seen that in a few places, but I don't understand because
where's the overt reference?
Yeah, they don't make any reference to drugs. I mean, as one of the things I was reading said, they made more. I mean, A, B, and C is a much more overt reference to hallucinogenic drugs than this one is.
Yes.
Yeah. And I've also read. I also read on IMDb. I don't know who is the person that fact checks the trivia stuff on that, but
I think that's the magic of IMDb.
Yeah.
You don't have to.
This seems kind of like a stretch. It says. The show was a summer filler for the Jackie Gleason show that only had, this says it only had 13 weeks, so Harmony was an easy one to drop. That doesn't make any sense because there's 17 episodes.
Right, and they showed 16.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if, I know that Canada, when Canada broadcast it, they only showed 13. So I'm wondering if maybe they were confused and this person meant that in Canada, maybe they dropped it.
That's probably a currency exchange issue, right? They're like, we can only afford 13 episodes.
16 episodes of The Prisoner is worth only 13 episodes in Canada.
I thought I read something that it was they didn't like the reference to anti-Vietnam.
Yes, that's the next thing I was going to say.
which
since
seems...
Then,
yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Since then, I believe people from CBS have have what's the fucking word?
They've admitted. They've sort of gone on record.
People from CBS have confirmed that the reason that they did not broadcast it was because it was a Western, which is very identifiably American, and because the entire plot of it is a anti-gun, anti-violence thing, they read it as having too many anti-war connotations. And this would have been broadcast in 1967, which was right in the middle of the Vietnam War.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
At the end of Vietnam.
Yeah. But yeah, so that was the reason why they didn't run it. Which, you know, was interesting. I don't know if that's if that intent was on purpose.
I don't really buy that.
Well, I mean, I buy that. I buy that they would make that decision. That's a very reactionary decision to make, and stations make that all the time.
I guess that infers a lot into audience intelligence, which I don't really think was a concern for them back then. I would think it's more just the violence in it, because this is a fairly violent episode.
Yeah.
There's a lynching. A woman gets strangled. A guy kills himself by falling off a balcony.
Yep.
That would be my interpretation. I think the CBS thing sounds like a post hindsight's 2020. They're like, well, this will probably sound better if we say that we just didn't want to stir up any anti-Vietnam sentiment. Because that's a very intelligent critique of that episode. You know?
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't doubt that they would have said something like that. Cause I mean, remember what happened after 9/11. I mean, anything that stuff becomes so heightened that you can read that stuff into everything.
Right.
You know, if you're Ted Cruz and you decide that you are not listening to rock music anymore because you're dissatisfied with the way that the rock community responded to
9/11. Imagine the career Drowning Pool could have had if only their song had not dealt with bodies hitting the floor post 9/11. Do you realize that 9/11 single-handedly destroyed Drowning Pool's career?
You know, I never thought about that till now. I hope that's what they say, too.
I'm sure that's on one of Osama's tapes. He's like, the real reason for 9/11.
Oh, God, that's really good.
Terrible. But, that's interesting. I'm just trying to see if you could draw any other symbolism to Vietnam. Six wins, so the West kind of wins. Communism doesn't win, which is backwards.
Yeah,
whatever. That's
yeah, but you know, I mean, people read into that stuff all the time.
Yep.
I'm reading a book about the old Hollywood in the 20s, and the people the films coming out during the height of Prohibition had a lot of pressure put on them by basically the same groups that made Prohibition happen, and you know, that's what ended up starting the Hays Code, which predates the modern rating system.
Sure.
Because people were reading into all of these things about, you know, this means this and this is sexual. Happened with comic books in the 50s.
Yep.
Before TV became a big thing, they needed something to focus their anger on, so they picked comic books. So how they ended up with the Comics Code Authority thing, where, you know, Robin was clearly gay and There were too many drawings that looked like vaginas, and yes. it's insane.
The penises in Disney.
Thing. But you know, people looking for something to criticize, or if you're heightened to that stuff, you're going to see it everywhere. You know,
yeah.
It's like with any interpretation of stuff. You know, if you're looking for something, you're going to find it.
Yep.
This episode was. It took the shortest time to write. Which is interesting because it's probably the best script.
Yeah. Yep.
And this is the episode that McGoohan enjoyed shooting the most, which
most fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely the most fun.
He has to put on his corduroys.
Yeah.
I was a little distracted by the corduroys, to be honest.
There was some of the costumes did remind me of when Marty McFly is dressed for the Old West by Doc Brown.
Yeah.
In Back to the Future 3.
It felt like a very British interpretation. Yeah. They're like, put on your tweed vest.
Very 60s British. There's that one guy, the first guy that that Sheriff Six has to beat up.
Yep.
Who like steps up to him is wearing like a fringed suede shirt with nothing underneath it. It's just like chest hair.
Yeah.
It was very strange. Apparently, the scenes in the village at the end were added as an afterthought by McGoohan to tie the show into the rest of the series, which goes back to what I think you were saying about kind of wishing that they hadn't done that at all and just it had just been a Western front to back.
I feel you need that scene. You do need to tie it
maybe
into...
Maybe I said that. I don't know. I can't remember.
I feel you need to... I don't think you could end it with him just being in the Western world because that would just be like, what the hell... happened.
Yeah, I think it's good that they're there.
Yeah,
For
as little time as that's all the time it needs.
Yeah, just, I mean, if it does make sense, then that ending, if it was like, let's see, how can we kill these characters off? We have like half of a day to shoot this.
Yeah,
you fall off a thing and you die, you get choked to death.
Where,
all right,
where's
let's
the
it.
Most
let's
dangerous go. Dangerous set on here? All right, here you.
What
fall.
If I what if I like fall and whack my head on the corner of the bar? It's like, no, nah, that doesn't really work.
Do you ever this is really tangential, but I think it's funny, the How Did This Get Made podcast.
Mm-hmm.
They did the Seagal movie. He's the something man.
Oh, the Glimmer Man.
Glimmer Man.
Yeah.
Where they're just saying people were working with Seagal, he wants to do the least amount, and they're saying somebody worked with him and he's just like, they had this whole fight scene planned out. They're like, you're gonna run over here, throw this guy through the table, then like karate kick this guy through this plate glass window, and he's like, how about I just sit in this chair and they come at me and I just kind of knock him down and I knock the other guy down. They're like, you're going to sit in the chair? He's like, yeah, I'm just going to sit in the chair. He doesn't want to do any of the work that's involved in making the fight scene.
Yeah, I heard another story from another podcast about that movie where now we're just, our next podcast should be telling stories we've heard on other podcasts.
We should start with news stories and then just be like, this reminds me of this movie where... The Glimmer Man.
Stephen Tobolowsky, who plays Ned Ryerson in Groundhog Day, was apparently the villain in that movie, which is weird. But there's a scene at the end where Seagal just like blows the crap out of him. He got like squibbed to hell and blood everywhere. And then after they had finished shooting, he gets a call and they're like, yeah, Steven's been like really into like a Buddhist kick lately. So he wants his character not to be as violent. So we're going to have to find a way to make it that you didn't die in that last scene.
Yep.
And he's like, what are you? My chest exploded. How am I supposed to? So apparently it's just him. There's like a voiceover of him going, why don't you just finish me? Anyway, that's neither here nor there. The last bit, which is pretty fun, is that apparently while McGoohan was off shooting Ice Station Zebra, he sent Alexis Kanner a telegram saying that he was taking quick draw lessons from Sammy Davis Jr. and Steve McQueen.
Wow.
And which then caused Kanner to practice his
his quick draw with Clint Eastwood.
which then caused Kanner to also start practicing his quick draw because there's that scene where they have the gunfight.
Yep.
And I guess the crew was taking bets as to who would be the faster draw.
Mm.
And if you slow it down, you can see that Kanner is faster.
Well.
But apparently he doesn't shoot as straight. Also a key point from Unforgiven, which we will be covering in our Unforgiven podcast starting in 3 weeks when we finish this show.
Start it up.
This is the Prisoner Podcast. Back in the Village, the Prisoner Podcast. And today we're talking about Unforgiven. We should just find tangential connections that we can just use as an excuse to talk about other movies.
Yeah. A B movie, the Seinfeld thing.
Just well, we actually had someone on Twitter asking if we were going to be covering any other post-Prisoner McGoohan things. Like he referenced Escape from Alcatraz, where he plays the warden.
The Columbo episodes.
The multiple Columbo episodes. And there's actually a movie that Alexis Kanner wrote and directed called Kings and Desperate Men, which is a great title.
Yeah.
Which
McGoohan's
co-starred
in it.
McGoohan, yeah.
Hmm.
I've never seen it. I don't know if it's any good, but...
Yeah, yeah.
You waiting for me, Judge? You wait? No more. You're gonna hit me? No more. No. No more!
Anyway, so that's about it. Final thoughts?
Good episode. Best one of the series so far.
Yeah. Looking forward to rounding it out. I mean, it's just such a good like breather episode to go into the, you know, we'll see how you feel about The Girl Who Was Death. I've never really it's never really clicked with me that much, but, sure. You know, we'll talk about that next week.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to plug anything?
Go to thepenskepodcast.com. If you like Star Trek The Next Generation, we're doing a podcast, and Clay helps out occasionally. Otherwise, you can go to the Penske File on YouTube, search that. There's a bunch of game stuff on there.
That actually reminds me. I was going to say, I forgot to say, this is basically a holodeck episode.
It is, kind of. Yeah.
Although he knows how everything works, unlike Picard.
For some reason. And the holodeck is much more insidious in that it just mentally kills you as opposed to creating things that are going to shoot you.
Oh, also, what do they do with that Western town when they're not doing this? Like, because that whole thing is actually there.
Yeah, just like, use it for like a theme park where the villagers can just go.
I guess. I mean, if the village itself is theme parky already, I mean, they got to have somewhere else to go, I guess.
I just imagine it's like a shooting range where the cardboard pop-ups just come up.
Yeah,
like,
probably.
Just,
yeah, I mean, because those cardboard things are there.
Yeah. I love the cardboard horse.
And yeah, as always, I am by no means an expert, so if you have anything you'd like to correct me on, or any trivia, or anything you'd like to discuss with me about the show, I'm always open to do that. You can contact us at theprisonerpodcast@gmail.com, or follow us on Twitter, @prisonerpodcast. We're on Facebook as well. I don't remember what it's called. You could type it in, you'll find it.
Back in the village, it comes in.
And yeah, so that's Living in Harmony, and we will be back next time with The Girl Who Was Deaf, getting pretty close to the end. So thank you guys for listening. We'll see you then.
Peace.
Well, there you go. There was Living in Harmony. I hope you enjoyed it. It's a different episode, but it's very cool. And next week, we will be back with another very different episode called The Girl Who Was Deaf. But in the meantime, if you happen to swing by iTunes and you feel like giving us a rating or a review, we would be much obliged. So, thanks in advance, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time with The Girl Who Was Deaf. Bye.